Live from the Nasdaq market site overlooking New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. I'm Melissa Lee. Your traders on the desk are Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Dan Nathan, and Guy Dami. Tonight on Fast, records fall on Wall Street as stocks soar to new all-time highs, but it's the big move in the bond market that's got all of us talking tonight. We'll tell you what happened in bondland that hasn't happened since President Trump won the election. Plus, the one chart to play as stocks enter uncharted waters. From Gap to Zillow, slew of stocks making moves after hours today. We'll break down what is behind all that action. But we begin with the stock to watch tonight. That would be Disney. Shares are jumping after the media giant reported better than expected earnings. CNBC's Julia Borson just sat down with the CEO, Bob Iger, joins us now with the very latest. Julia.
Melissa, that's right. While Disney beat revenue and earnings expectations, driven by success at the parks and the studio, the big news is about Disney's big bet on streaming, with Disney Plus launching Tuesday. Bob Iger announcing in our interview that Disney Plus has a distribution agreement now with Amazon, Samsung, and LG. That's in addition to other existing agreements with Apple, Google, and others. Iger also announcing a new plan to bolster Hulu with FX.
For the first time, FX will be creating original series for Hulu. In fact, we're going to start with four of them. There are four of them in production now, and they'll be available on Hulu starting in probably late March. We're also going to enable viewers to watch FX shows on Hulu soon after they have aired on FX, just a few hours later.
Iger announcing that ESPN Plus now has 3.5 million subscribers. That's the addition of over 1 million over the course of the last quarter. Now, I asked Iger if all of Disney's investment in streaming threatens to cannibalize its core media networks business.
We don't believe that what we're doing is really damaging our bread and butter, to use your words. What we really are doing is really a couple of things. First of all, we're giving consumers an opportunity to watch sports in new, sometimes considered more modern ways, more convenient ways. We're also establishing a path for us to continued basically success or profitability should the initial or the traditional business model be disrupted to such an extreme that it's a necessary transition that we have to make.
Now, Disney's earnings call is going on right now, and the company's CFO just announced that protests in Hong Kong have led to a significant decrease in tourism, and they do expect operating income at Hong Kong Disneyland to decline about $80 million in the fiscal first quarter. That's this current quarter. Now, Iger said he's not focused on competition. We asked him if he subscribes to Netflix. He admits he does. Melissa, back over to you.
All right, Julia, thank you. Julia Borson in Los Angeles for us. Let's go to the man who owns Disney and also successfully fast-pitched Disney. So you're riding high tonight.
The blind squirrel, as we say.
Yeah.
But the thing about Disney that got me so excited on that fast pitch was that this is a company that I want to own for four different reasons: studio, parks and recreation, DTC or consumer products, and ultimately the streaming service and the media business. And this is something around the media business. We don't really know what blended multiple to apply to the company. But when you look at parks and studio, I mentioned that studio is the gift that keeps on giving. So studio drives parks, and it drives all the consumer products business. Whether that's driving ultimately the streaming business, we'll see. Disney certainly has made between that Amazon distribution deal and the fact that they've got every major distributor out there. And I would argue, who do you want to have? I would much rather have Disney than almost anybody else if I'm a major. If they had to choose one, I think they'd rather own Disney. So you look at the multiple, you look at where this stock relative to the rest of the market. You know, you could have bought Disney today before this numbers if you were scouring and screening to see what hasn't run, what's a blue chip, what's a valuation. And I think you still can do that after these numbers. So these were great numbers. We didn't even learn anything about the streaming business, and yet we know that they're going to be in the thick of things.
Right. What you mentioned was the flywheel effect. I mean, it's got that going right now, and theoretically it should help the streaming business as well. I mean, if it helps studios, it should help content, which will then be on the streaming service.
Right, right. He does sort of just touch on the idea of the cannibalization of it. He denies that that's an issue, but it has to be an issue, right? I mean, ABC, linear TV, that has to be an issue, but good for them. You can either do something about it, which they absolutely are, right? They're absolutely addressing it. I kind of agree with Tim. I mean, the numbers were great, but it's up nicely, but it's not materially more expensive today with these earnings even up this much. The story is still very much.
I think the streaming stuff is really interesting. I listened to the whole interview that was on in the 4 o'clock hour. I mean, he said they gained 1 million ESPN Plus subscribers. They have 28.5 million Hulu subscribers. I think Hulu is a really important part of this direct-to-consumer bundle. This is also live TV, and it's one way for them to aggregate a lot of their content in a different sort of way. And I think that investors are willing to give Disney a pass, especially with those losses right now as they ramp this service. I don't think, and you know, expectations for Disney Plus are maybe 5 million by the end of the year. We know they just launched that deal with Verizon. Verizon has 150 million subs here, so that could be a very sticky thing. So I think you're probably going to see expectations for Disney Plus kind of ramp for 2020. And going back to your blended multiple, you know, if you looked at in the quarter, the media revenue is about $6.5 billion and direct-to-consumer is about half that. So as long as they, back to your cannibalization issue, they keep growing that at a better clip, start to reduce the losses there, and I think you have a story where this stock is at new highs and not too distant future.
As Tim pointed out in that incredible power pitch.
Yeah. All right.
The setup for the fast pitch, right? That one was really good as well.
Good too, yeah.
The setup was really interesting. You know, off from that 147 high back in July, traded down to 125, basically a 50% retracement of a move we saw from the spring. So the setup in earnings was really nice. Number one. Number two, don't discount this ESPN thing. And I remember sitting on this desk now, it seems like 2 years ago, when Disney was a $99 stock and floundering, and then it was reported during our show that all of a sudden gambling's being legalized. That was a lifeline that ESPN needed. That's why people are flocking back to ESPN, because I'll tell you, not that I gamble on sports, but you're far more inclined to watch if you have money on a game than if you don't. And that's, I think, why ESPN is doing as well as they're doing now. What does it mean? Well, 147 and change was the high back on July 29th or so. That's your line in the sand. We need a close above there over the next week or so. I don't know if it gets there tomorrow, but I think that's your bogey. 25 times next year's earnings. You can make an argument, I think, to Karen's point, in this environment, maybe it's not that crazy expensive.
With these earnings in the books, does that lessen the pressure on the launch next week of Disney Plus?
I think so. And because we don't know what those numbers are. Remember, they gave us numbers. I think they said 7 million subs and then 24 million subs by the end of 2024. We've all surmised here and tried to guess whether some of these distribution channels actually increase it and whether ESPN Plus is actually telling you you're going to be stronger. I think they're getting the benefit of the doubt. In fact, it's interesting. The irony is that as the competition heats up, it seems like everybody's getting a little bit of a pass in the short run. In other words, look at Netflix. Despite the fact that, you know, it had a lot of pressure once these announcements were made, you've arguably seen Netflix rally as competition has gotten a little bit tighter in the last month or so. The thing about Disney that I just want, maybe I've already said this, but I want to say it again. There's four businesses here that are all kicking it. Studio is up 52%. Operating income is up 72% overall. And that's a business that's a $6.5 billion business. Parks and Resorts, $6.5 billion business. The media business, $6.5 million business. Studio is about 3.5. And then if you look at the DTC, another 3.5. You have four large businesses that are all doing very well separately. And that's why I just think that this isn't just a media company. This is kind of a must own.
You made the point yesterday that we might not know really the fallout of this for at least 6 months, maybe right. Even longer, as people start really looking at what the content offerings are and deciding how much they're going to pay for what. So right. At this point with Disney's run, I mean, that's a lot, given we're not really going to know the numbers for a very long
now
time.
Now, that either it works to their benefit or not, right? Yeah. It depends on how the launch goes. I just think we don't have enough information to know. But to Tim's point, what we do know about the businesses that are not in as big flux, right? Everything's going really well, though, you know, studios are very lumpy. They shouldn't get a huge multiple. To me, though, it all comes back to Netflix. How can Netflix be valued here when Disney's there? Right? I just don't get it.
Well, here's one, though, that I go back to the parent of CNBC. Comcast is a cheap stock, trading 13 times next year's expected earnings growth of about 11%, 5% sales growth. I mean, to me, you think of a lot of the dynamics that Disney is kind of keying on right now. This is stuff that Comcast has had in the works for a long time. I mean, I think a lot of these stocks can work. Netflix. I think that we've seen North American subs decline, two quarters in a row now. They're at a price point. They just raised their prices earlier in this year. And Disney Plus, we know, is $6 or something like that. And they're taking off all their content and they're going to make it right there. I just think that one of the things that Disney will start to trade off of when this service launches next week, they're going to introduce this Mandalorian. It's a Star Wars show. Jon Favreau's the director.
I cannot wait for it.
But think about it. This is a $6 a month service. You get all your Marvel, you get all your Lucas, you get all your Pixar, you get all your Disney sort of stuff, and they're going to be branching out, doing a lot of the stuff that's just exclusive to their service.
So Comcast is interesting, the parent company of this network, by the way, because they have theoretically the same pieces in place to create that same flywheel as Disney.
Sure.
Can it, though, create as strong and powerful a flywheel as Disney?
At half the valuation, though, I mean, is it worth making that bet? I mean, it's half the valuation of Disney, effectively right here. Half the valuation of Comcast, by the way, is CBS, which has been floundering recently, bouncing off the bottom. So at a certain point, you play the valuation game. So I don't even know if in terms of Comcast, you need to know the answer. You just have to make the bet that, listen, we can all agree that Disney deserves the multiple they get. But should Comcast trade at half that multiple? Shouldn't they get a little bump in this environment? And then shouldn't CBS? And I can't wait for this mandolin rain. It's going to be unbelievable when it comes out.
Maybe
I will
you
be.
And Dan can watch it together.
I can only hope. Can Sharing you, Dan, will you do that?
Yeah, we'll do that. It'll be fun.
Our next guest knows a thing or two about media as a former executive of both Hulu and Netflix. Let's bring in SPG's Simon Gallagher for his take on Disney's quarter. Simon, great to have you with us.
Great to be on.
It sounds like you're more concerned about the decline in its legacy business and the ability of the new business to sort of offset that.
Yeah, look, I think so. You're looking at the Disney Plus business not necessarily turning a profit until 2023. It's still a long way out, and the rapid decline of the broadcast and the network and the broadcast networks and also the pay TV channels, it's happening very rapidly, and I'm not sure that the Disney Plus business is going to lift the numbers fast enough to offset that decline.
But eventually, do you think they will?
Look, they're predicting some very big numbers. I think that Disney has always had a great business, but do I think it can? Look, I'm not sure. I'm very optimistic. What Disney now is, though, with the Fox acquisition, is this really global business. I love the fact that they've acquired Hotstar in India as part of the Fox acquisition. So there's some new businesses coming into the fray that I think maybe the analyst community hasn't looked at too deeply that may start to see them re-rate Disney a little bit.
Hey, Simon, it's Tim. Thanks for joining us. And I'm not asking you to play trader, but we talk about Netflix all the time, and we just talked about Netflix, where there is no profitability. There's a major cash burn, and people and investors have been willing to give the company the benefit because they're banking on essentially this distribution and effectively certainly a leadership in terms of that pipeline. Talk about that and bring it back to Disney, which doesn't necessarily for the market have to be profitable on that core business right now.
Sure. Netflix, I think, and I said this last time I was on the network, are very clever about bringing down that P-E ratio. It's, I think, 92 today, and I think you're going to see that P-E ratio come down over time. Reed Hastings yesterday on DealBook and on the network was heard to say, we're going to continue to spend, but I think they're going to continue to spend sensibly. So they will still spend a lot of money on high-profile shows, but they're getting smarter and smarter about the volume of shows that they need. And some assets, they can curate the roster, so to speak. So they can bring down what shows are not necessarily performing for them and spend more on other shows. So you have to, I was thinking about in preparation for the show today, I was thinking, would you rather be managing a declining broadcast and pay TV business at Disney, or would you rather be trying to manage to bring your PE ratio down in Netflix? It's an interesting challenge at both businesses.
Simon, excuse me, thank you very much for your time. It's great to have you.
Luck. Thank you.
I'm so happy that he plays Would You Rather.
You could do it at home.
Would You Rather.
Holy cow.
At home.
That's awesome.
I think it's a good sign.
Groundbreaking television here, Fast Money.
Why are you looking at me?
I thought that was really interesting. I mean, I think here's the issue. They have no choice. They have a declining media business. And so why is Bob Iger still in the CEO seat? They've made some huge bets over the last few years as he's extended out his tenure, and he's going to see this thing out. So it's going that way one way or another. And I suspect that we're not done seeing consolidation among media assets. You know what I mean? Like, there's probably more for them to buy. They're going to probably buy an EA or something like that. Let's really broaden out all of this content, right, and be a one-stop shop on multiple mediums. So that's, I suspect, the bet that's going to be going on for Disney for decades.
All right. Coming up, Gap shares plunging after announcing CEO Art Peck is leaving the company. We'll find out what is next for the retailer. Plus, the 10-year yield seeing its biggest gain since the 2016 election. And that's got one top technician putting his faith back into one sector. He'll tell us what it is. We're live from Times Square in New York City. Much more Fast Money right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. We are following a developing story on Gap in the after-hours session. That stock is down about 6% on news that CEO Art Peck is stepping down. Courtney Reagan's at the NYSE with the details. Hey, Court. Hi, Melissa. This was a bit of a surprise to the market. At least we didn't get any indication that this was going to happen. CEO Art Peck is stepping down from Gap Inc., which means he will not be leading sort of the RemainCo company with Gap, Banana Republic, and Athleta once the Old Navy division does spin out, which is expected to happen by 2020. And in this release, Gap also giving us some guidance on the third quarter, saying comps are down 4%. The Street had expected them to be down, but just 2.2%. Also saying third quarter earnings will be in a range of 34 cents to 36 cents adjusted. The Street was looking for 55 cents. The full year guidance also pretty far below what the Street is looking for. The CFO cites macro impact, slower foot traffic, also pressuring results that were further hampered by product and operating challenges. CEO Art Peck actually just speaking here in New York recently, just at the very end of October, at the WWD conference, talking about sustainability, not giving any, at least public indication, that this was happening. Shares are down 6%, but again, a combination of the guidance and Peck stepping down. He became CEO in February of 2015. He has been with the company since 2005 and has held a variety of different positions. He's led digital. He's led the outlet. He led Gap North America. So we'll see what happens here with the company. In the interim, Robert Fisher, who is the non-executive chairman of the board, will be taking over. So there is no permanent successor that has been named at this point. Back over to you.
Thank you very much, Courtney Reagan, with the details on Gap. You know, when I heard this news, I turned to Karen. I said, why is he going to step down before the company separates? And you said, probably a lousy quarter. You hit the nail on the head.
So another blind squirrel. This is the blind squirrel side. But I think, you know, the stock is really, really cheap, but it deserves to be really, really cheap. They've been sort of meandering and had a really tough time. I think the spin of Old Navy is probably the right thing to do. I don't think you need to touch it. I mean, we got to wait. We got to see who they get. And then if they get somebody great, the stock will trade up. If they get somebody okay, whoever the person is, they'll come in and they'll do a kitchen sink quarter, right? Mark it down as much as they can.
Some more downside ahead.
I think so. I think there's just better places to be.
Or maybe they don't get anybody. They let the interim keep going and they sell the thing off.
That's possible. They're not selling from a position of strength.
To who?
But,
right, right, true.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
Private equity
I don't
depends
know.
On the price. I guess it just depends on the price.
It's interesting. On a day when Ralph Lauren was up, I don't know, 15%, and another brand that seems like it's left for dead. Maybe we'll talk about that later in the show. But I think you have a case. If you took a look at L Brands, you look at a couple other brands that were legacy brands that have been struggling to find their way because the core cash cow has suddenly run out of gas at a time when the entire distribution model is probably broken to online.
So remember this guide, the third quarter guide. So they report on November 21st, I think. That's two weeks. I can do that math in my head. So just remember 34 cents to 38 cents, because to Karen's point, I bet you they guide lower off the guide lower, and that could be catastrophic. 15.5 was the low we saw, I think, in July. And in terms of the foot, Yogi Berra, they asked him about a restaurant years ago. I happened to be in the interview, and Karen knows what I'm going to say. You know, nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded.
Right.
Well, nobody goes to Gap anymore.
It's not crowded.
It's not about being crowded.
It's
just
right.
Nobody goes.
It's still not crowded.
So that's the point. I mean, so I think you got to wait and see on the 21st. I think it trades down to 15.5.
It's funny. So you're talking about retailers that are brands. You know, the department stores are kind of interesting here. You know, we're going to get the reports in the next couple weeks. It's going to be before Black Friday. Like Macy's.
In a good way?
Well, yeah, but look at this.
Hold on. Because you have been as outspoken against department stores as being dead on arrival
to
anybody.
Well, here's the thing. Macy's is a great example. I mean, Nordstrom's is up 50% from its, its 52-week lows, and Macy's is up 15%. It is DOA. I mean, the thing is stuck in a range here. But, you know, it kind of reminds me a little bit of U.S. Steel prior to their earnings last week. This was a stock that was also down 50-so% from the 52-week highs. Sentiment was so bad. They don't even have to say anything good for the stock to go up. They just don't have to say anything bad. And we're kind of in a market here where we're making incremental new highs now every single day, 30 bips here on the S&P or whatever. Sooner or later, you're going to look for things to kind of play some catch up. And we're seeing that. We saw it in energy. We're seeing it in some of these material stocks. You might see it if the consumer data is increasingly better. Why wouldn't you take a shot on some of these things?
Well,
amazing.
Guy's bad Yogi Berra joke would probably apply to
Macy's. Bad.
As well. Yogi Berra's the best.
Sorry. It feels like deja vu all over again next time you say that, by the way. But if you think about Macy's and U.S. Steel, I think the thing that's the most aligned is balance sheet issues. When people talk about Macy's, a lot of times they're talking about what they have to do because of the balance sheet. They're certainly doing that at U.S. Steel, so any relief on the balance sheet's important.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot more fast money ahead. That's concerning retail here. We've got a big move today coming up. We'll break down the big move higher on the high end as well. Here's what we've got coming up on the docket.
Major moves in the bond market as stocks climb to new highs. We'll break down one sector that has been leading the rally. Plus, putting the bling back in the luxury space. We'll look at one stock that's leading the charge today. We've got that and a lot more when Fast Money returns.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Markets soaring today as stocks hit fresh record highs, but it was the move in bonds that was staggering, the yield on the 10-year seeing its biggest single-day jump since President Trump was elected back in 2016. The big move following back-and-forth reports that the U.S. and China plan to phase out some tariffs. So what do you think? It felt like the equity side of the markets were a little bit skeptical of those headlines from the very beginning.
Again, the volatility in the bond market, if we saw half the volatility in the equity market that we see in the bond market, it would be headline news every day, 24-7. It's remarkable, these moves. I mean, the 10-year yield seemingly a couple weeks ago was 150. Now it's north of 190. That percentage-wise is incredible. I think volatility in the bond market of this magnitude is not a healthy sign. Equity market clearly sees something else. But I thought 180 sort of was the line in the sand for a reversal back lower. Now we're significantly above it. I think Dan's going to probably tell you something around 2.25%, and then is when the equity market starts to get worried.
Are you going to say something?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm just a dumb stock jockey, but I'll just tell you this, that the markets didn't love when rates were going lower this summer too much, and they're not going to love it if they go up too fast, too. I don't know what the number is, whether it's 2% was the breakdown in the 10-year Treasury yield that I think that people really wanted to see kind of hold early in the summer. So I just don't know. I you know, with the stock market making new highs every day, if we see rates go up too quickly, I think that becomes a problem.
Isn't it a good sign that we've kind of held on in the equity side despite this big move?
I think so. I never understood I hope we have bad data so the Fed continues to cut so then the economy can improve. I'd rather just have the economy improve, which seems to be what's happening.
But
so I think it's a good sign until it gets far higher than here, I think.
There's no question it's a good sign. And if you look back where we were even on October 3rd, the day we really kind of rallied the entire market, we've now gone almost 9% on the S&P in 25 sessions since then. Bond yields were kind of in the 150s or getting, you know, somewhere down near there. There's no question we were seeing a deflationary low growth spiral, and that was part of it. But think about some of this has totally coincided with a Fed that has jacked up its balance sheet again. And again, I'm talking about stealth QE, which you can't deny is happening. We're over $4 trillion on the Fed's balance sheet. We've now cut three times in a row. Are we still reliant on the Fed here? But I think in the short run, that bond move was somewhat dependent upon what was going on in European yields. And if you look at bond yields and JGB yields, they're right now maybe more important. They are both up 70% off of their lows, and I think they are driving U.S. Treasuries.
All right. Well, the monster move into the bond market having some impact on the financials, and one top technician's doubling down on his bullish bank bet. Let's get to Chris Verona, strategist. He's over at the Plasmas to break it all down. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Mel. And listen, I think we have to start with what kicked off this entire move. And that's the uninversion of the yield curve. This is U.S. 2s and 10s, so 10-year yield minus 2-year yield. This is the low, negative 5 basis points on August 27th. I think the irony, late August, recession talk is pervasive. The PMI had just printed sub 50. That is when this move towards financials and cyclicality really began. So now we have a choice here. We have banks up 22% since late August. Are we going to take profit or are we going to press? And I think we press here. And I'm going to give you a couple names where there's more to go. Citigroup, obviously a bellwether. But let's just go back and think about the history here. This is a stock that doubled off the 16 lows. We then had a 40% drawdown over the last 2 years. It is just beginning to come out of this base. We got up through that key 73 level. I think the next near-term target's 86. I think longer-term, this is a $100 name. Goldman Sachs, one of the brokers. Another name, it's had a bear market, down 47% over the last 2 years. Again, starting to bottom here, just broke out above that 222 level. I think tactically, 250 is the name there. And then lastly, and we almost feel dirty saying it because it's been such a bad stock for so long, but even the European banks quietly acting better. This is Deutsche Bank. I think we're near resolution. We've been this little wedge here for the last number of weeks. We think ultimately this one breaks out. The one number that I want to give you here, there are 30 analysts that cover DB. Only one of them has a buy on it. Extremely out of consensus. The chart is getting better. Its peers around the world are improving. The curve continues to steepen. Be long banks, double down.
All right, Chris, come on over. I mean, no question about Chris, okay, right?
Can we just say something about Will, who's bringing the chair as Chris comes up? He cracked his head the other night, bleeding.
Bleeding into his
staying on the show.
Playing hurt.
Staples in his head, and he's
like,
still
for
here.
For real staples.
Well, for real staples.
Players play hurt.
Ouch. All right, Deutsche Bank.
Yeah.
So do you think, so is it Deutsche Bank specifically, or does Commerce Bank also have a light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, I think what's interesting, when you look at that part of the world, I even put Japan in this camp. All the dirtiest banks, right, the ones that have been terrible for 2 years, all turning here as well. Deutsche Bank can go 7 to 10. It's a 30% rally. Now, this was a $30 stock a few years ago, right? But these moves, I think, are just beginning. Look at the Japanese banks have all started to turn here as well. UniCredit. Also turning.
Garbage.
So this is a group move, and the garbage names tend to go up the most when that's the case.
So in a game of would you rather, would you choose U.S. banks or European banks?
I think ultimately we're people who play for duration and time horizon. Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America are still best of breed charts. That is where we play structurally.
Okay. The move in the bond market also has implications on the dividend-yielding stocks, and we've seen that play out a little bit. So what are you seeing in terms of where that trade goes? I mean, is the air gone from that trade?
I think what's so remarkable, bring your mind back to late summer. It was August. The recession talk was pervasive. The yield curve had just inverted. The PMI had just broken 50. And then all of a sudden, you start to see this move towards cyclicality, right? So we had 13, 14 months of lower interest rates. There's a stimulative effect to that. And there's all different corners of the world that are starting to price that in right now. And that's at the expense of those very high PE utilities, staple stocks. I don't think those are done correcting. I think there's a move towards cyclicality. I think it's just beginning, and you want to use any weakness to get bigger there.
So this is, you're talking about the beginning of an overshoot to the upside, and you mentioned 85, I think, in terms of Citi, which I guess you can make an argument for, but are they going to just catch up to where J.P. Morgan is valuation-wise, or does J.P. Morgan sort of rise along with them?
I mean, I think what's notable when we talk about JPM, this is the only U.S. bank at an all-time high, right? It's the highest level it's ever been. It spent 2.5 years going nowhere. I think the message here is don't get too cute. These breakouts are 2 or 3 weeks old. Press them here.
All right, Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Chris Verone. What are you buying, European or U.S.
Well,
banks?
That's interesting. So if you want the European banks, look at that EUFN, which is a European bank ETF, which is basically only begun to fight. Again, as Chris pointed out, they have just started to run. And who is more levered to higher interest rates? The European banks have been destroyed by the ECB. They may have been bailed out, but they've also been destroyed. So I think that's interesting. And I would just say the rest of the world trade is also significantly outperforming the U.S. EM's outperformed by about 6.5%. The DAX in local terms or in dollar terms has outperformed by about 7% since October.
Are you feeling better about banks? I feel like since you feel better about retail names, maybe you also feel better about
listen,
banks.
Listen, I said a few weeks ago, and I did it on Options Action, I said J.P. Morgan's breaking out and, and just buy
JP
calls.
Morgan specifically.
But I've also been saying, like, listen, when you look at those technicals, take the name off of it, and you look at the environment, you look at the market sentiment, say, yes, they should break out, and they should continue to go. I just don't, I can't put my finger on the fundamental drivers. I want to make one point on the TLT, because this was one of my final trades last week. I actually think that rates probably see in the 10-year, they probably see some resistance at 2%. If you look at the chart of the TLT, it's been in this nice uptrend. It just literally bounced off of it today at 135. That was also the breakout level at July 31st. So to me, I think TLT looks like a decent setup if you think the rate run has kind of come to an end or see some resistance. And that is some cheap fall if you want to play it through options. There's a free OA for you right there, people.
Wow, bonus.
Free OA.
At the money,
calls
are
good OA.
Cheap. Wow.
Yeah, good stuff.
Coming up, it wasn't just Disney out with earnings. Dropbox, Zillow on the move after their reports. We'll give you the highlights from their calls. And Alibaba gearing up for Singles Day. The world's biggest made-up shopping bonanza. Options traders see more love for Baba in the cards. We will break it all down. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Fast Money. We've got an earnings whip on some after-hours movers. Dropbox and Zillow on the move after reporting. Deidre Bosa standing by on Dropbox. We begin with Diana Olick, who is covering Zillow. Diana.
Well, Melissa, it was a really solid beat for Zillow. Q3 consolidated revenue more than doubled year over year. That sent the stock up 10% in after hours. And that was driven by outperformance in the premier agent segment and improved margin in Zillow's advertising business. Now, the ad business is profitable, but the new iBuyer business is not. Zillow's currently using that traditional advertising and website business to fund its new home buying and selling business. The iBuyer segment, which investors have been watching very closely, saw revenue of $384 million. That's a 55% sequential increase from Q2. I mean, in Q3 of last year, it reported just $11 million in revenue from that segment. During Q3, Zillow Offers purchased over 2,200 homes, sold over 1,200, ending the quarter with 2,822 homes on its balance sheet. It launched in eight new markets in Q3 and will expand to Los Angeles by the end of this year with plans to be in 26 markets by 2020.
This kind of growth from a standing start may not be unique, but it is certainly rare, and was our hope to not just get and it was our hope to not just get on the field in this big, exciting consumer category, but to become the team to beat.
Now, Zillow also launched a new flex pricing plan for its agents where they only pay a fee after the deal is closed. It's being tested in a few markets. Outside of those markets, though, Premier Agent revenue grew 3% year over year. And Zillow also saw very strong 19% revenue growth in its rental listings business. We all know how hot that rental market is. Back to you guys.
Diana, thank you. Diana Olick in Washington for us on Zillow. It's interesting because that very segment of the business where they're buying and selling homes themselves and having to carry the homes on the balance sheet, that is the part of the business that was strong in this quarter. That's what attracted a lot of shorts in the stock.
I think it should attract a lot of shorts. It went from a very asset light, high margin business to a very asset heavy, low margin business. That doesn't quite make sense.
Linked to the economy. Right.
So and
totally cyclical.
And we had Steve Eisman on. Remember, this is a short of his. And he talked about why it's not a monolith of it's all these tiny different markets that one needs to get up to speed in. I don't get it. There's a big short interest here. I think it's about
7%.
24. I had 24. Correct me if that's wrong. But so any beat, you know, you're going to see some pain here. But I don't love that part of the business at all.
Yeah, this was a bounce back type of a print for a company that's so well documented here on the short side. I do think that there is still cyclicality to this business. I think at some point interest rates are an issue. They're not here. Existing home sales, though, have gotten a bit of a bump here on interest rates. And I think the cyclicality that they added to their core business model makes zero sense. And that's not where you want to be.
I think you're asking yourself, where do you put a short back at? I mean, this was a $51 stock this summer that cratered. I think it traded down to 28.5, 29. So now you have to start to do the math. Like, what are the shorts? Are they going to cover here? Some of them probably will. I would imagine Mr. Eisman would probably layer back in. But I think the real level, if you're so inclined, 40 or so would be a 50% retracement of that high this summer and the low we recently saw. I think the play is to let the shorts cover, get out, hope it trades up to 40, then layer in another short position.
All right, we've got a news alert for you. The race for president may soon be getting a little more crowded. Elon Moy's got this breaking news. Elon.
Melissa, NBC News has now confirmed that Michael Bloomberg is preparing to enter the Democratic presidential candidacy. The New York Times had reported earlier that he was expected to file paperwork in Alabama sometime this week. That state does have an early filing deadline, but the New York Times did caution that that still doesn't mean he is 100% certain that he will run. It just means that his campaign could potentially be increasing how serious it is about entering this field. Now, obviously, if he does enter, that could change the dynamic of this race. This race has been defined by the debates over the economy, over wealth, over the ways that businesses have amassed corporate power. Michael Bloomberg, of course, billionaire businessman, former mayor for New York. And again, NBC News now confirming that he is preparing to enter this race. Back to you, Melissa.
Elon, thank you. Elon Moy in D.C. How does this change the race? If you are a moderate Democrat, particularly one who works in this business that we are all associated with, I would imagine this is a very viable alternative to what is currently out on the market. 100%.
I mean, Karen did a little cheer before during the commercial break, and I understand why. I mean, I think he sees an opportunity given some of the polarization that's going around, given some of the Scott Wapner's interview he was probably watching. He said, you know what, maybe I have a shot here. Maybe there's an entry point. makes sense. I don't know what he's gunning for, because I don't know if ultimately he can be the president or get elected. But I think this really changes the dynamic.
Well, what I think he's trying to do is, like, listen, you know, who has kind of caught a lot of steam over the last couple of months? It's been Warren and it's been Bernie. Yeah. And they're not something that is going to bring the middle in a general election. So what Bloomberg can do is kind of bring this back a little bit more towards the center, at least on the Democratic side. And that this is a question we've been hearing a lot. What does it mean for the markets if Warren is, you know, should be good news.
Yeah, I mean, it's all you're doing is you're setting up a middle of the road playing field for markets, which, look, whatever you want to say, we went from a pendulum that went this way to a pendulum that went this way in terms of regulation versus not regulation. Say what you want about political ideology, because some of it's very confusing today. But I'll say this. If you get a centrist candidate for a market that expects some type of change, that's going to take a lot of the edge out of next year's tension, at least on the overall. We know that there are certain sectors that are going to come under particular duress. And let's be clear, this banking sector that's off and running is off and running because there is zero regulation out there right now. I'm not saying banks are bad guys either. I'm just telling you, relative to the environment
yeah,
that they had been in.
I don't think there's zero regulation.
Well, I think there's
a lot of regulation.
There's a lot of compliance. There's a lot of rules. There's a lot of compliance. There's a lot of, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley. There's a lot of, you know, necessary governance around it. But I don't think that there's an incredible amount of push on banks to say, get out of the game, where I think that was the predisposition of the other administration.
All right. Let's get back to earnings here. Turn to another stock moving in the after hours. Dropbox. It is lower by 1% on its report. Deidre Bose is in San Francisco with the details. Deidre.
Hey, Melissa. Well, shares have been bouncing around since the results hit, and they still are. So bear with me while I tell you what's happening on the call. Shares moved into positive territory after CFO Ajay Vashee revised up their full year revenue guidance range. Those after hour gains pushing Dropbox slightly above that IPO price of $21. But the backdrop here is that Dropbox hasn't really gone anywhere since going in public in March of 2018. The key has been paid user growth, and it hasn't been as strong as the street has hoped. So the company has been undergoing a reinvention this year. It's moving further into cloud services. It revamped its desktop app, partnered with the likes of Slack and Zoom, and it is still focusing on getting more enterprises onto its platform. On the call, CEO Drew Houston said that they are seeing early success from what he called the new Dropbox. He said millions of people have used that since its launch. The Q&A portion getting underway. No surprise, analysts are asking about engagement. Shares, I should note, turned red again a few minutes ago, and they're down now as execs said that they're expecting slightly lower paid user growth over the next few quarters. Back to you.
All right, Deidre, thank you. Deidre Bosa in San Francisco. Dan.
Yeah, so, I mean, Deidre just said it. This was a March 2018 IPO. There was still a lot of optimism about these sorts of cloud-based businesses. Here's the problem. This is a revenue base that's only growing like 15% a year, and on a GAAP basis, they lose money on their sales of $1.6 billion expected this year. So it's just not that exciting of a story. That's why this thing is watched out. And they didn't really give you anything there to say that things are changing.
All right, coming up, luxury stocks seeing some rich gains lately. We'll tell you which names could bring a shine to your portfolio. Plus, Alibaba gearing up for the Super Bowl of shopping as Singles Day gets ready to kick off. We'll tell you how options traders are betting on this big event. Don't go anywhere. Much more Fast Money right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks hitting new all-time highs today after China said it reached an agreement with the U.S. to roll back some tariffs. And that news could not have come at a better time for Chinese retail giant Alibaba. Singles Day, the world's biggest online shopping event, is coming up this Monday. And with the stock jumping higher today, options traders are betting even more gains are on the horizon. XP Investments Managing Director Bonwin Eisen is over at the Plasma to break down the action. Bonwin, welcome. What are you seeing in terms of the action?
So let's hop right into it. As you said, Singles Day next week, we'll see how the market is shaping up. So as you can see, with option volume, calls outpace puts almost 3 times to 1. Not a shocker. This stock has been on an absolute tear. Let's take a look at what the at-the-money straddles are implying. You can see here that the NOV straddles are implying about a 3% move in either direction between now and next week's expiration. I'd like to dive in a bit deeper into this implied volatility and see if we can identify some trends and opportunities. All right, so what we have here is short-term implied volatility over the last 6 months. And what you can see is that we've sold off pretty aggressively. And right here, post-earnings, we've really sold off. All right, this area right here presents a real great opportunity for us to get in and get long some options at a discount. Let's take it a step further, keeping that in mind. What we have here for you is a stock chart. And there's two trends at play here. The first being, well, we have a short-term uptrend that's been extremely aggressive here. Secondly, what we have is a long-standing resistance level around this $180 level, which has been in play for some time. We've continued to test this time and time again and have just recently broken through with some real velocity here, real options volume, real stock volume as well. So taking all this into account, how do I like playing it? Well, if you think this trend continues, what I like buying is a November at-the-money calls. Your cash outlay is about 1.5%, putting your break even well within striking distance of where the stock is currently. That's why I'm playing it.
All right, Bonawin, great to see you. Thank you. Bonawin Eisen of XP Investments. Dan.
Really good trade setup. I mean, he identified a catalyst there. He's telling us that the price of options are really cheap. And then the technical setup, it has not been able to break out above that level. So the fact that you can risk 1.5% over the next week and a half with that catalyst, that looks like a really good trade setup to me.
All right, for more options action, full show Friday, tomorrow, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Up next, shares of Ralph Lauren racking up some big gains on its earnings results. We'll tell you what drove the quarter. Plus, take a look at the Cramer cam. Jim's got the need for speed. He's laying out who the real winners are in the race to 5G. We're live at the NASDAQ in Times Square. Much more Fast Money still ahead. Oh, it's raining. Oh. Anybody have an umbrella? Guy, you have yours?
I do. Storm Dud.
Yeah, that's what we lovingly call them.
Galoshes.
Welcome back to Fast Checkout. Shares of Ralph Lauren racking up some big gains, posting its best day since last May on the back of earnings. Ralph Lauren is one of the retailers, luxury retailers, that's been shiny of late. Check out shares of Tiffany, Capri Holdings, Tapestry, all beating the broader market over the past month. So should investors be looking to luxury to bolster their portfolio? At any one time, Karen, I feel like you've owned a few of these
names.
Yes,
probably, and I do now. I mean, Ralph Lauren, which is one that I don't own today, up a lot. I thought it was up actually more than I would have expected given what they announced, which was fine. I mean, you know, we saw some better pricing. That's good. Some better pricing in their outlets. North America was good. Asia weaker, but, you know, that's not specific to them at all. Obviously, anyone with Hong Kong exposure and the general China tariff situation. So it was a great quarter relative to if you have a low bar, I guess. So the stock here is sort of okay. Not great in terms of the relative value. I look at something like Capri, which is Michael Kors, Versace, and Jimmy Choo. Clearly, it would seem they paid way too much for Versace, but that's old news already and priced in. They announced yesterday the stock was, I don't know, down 28 cents or so, and today seemed to react like, oh, if Ralph Lauren trades at 15 times earnings, maybe we shouldn't trade at 6.75 times earnings. That's sort of surprising to me that it continues to trade here. A lot of the things that helped Ralph were working in Kors as well. Michael Kors itself did better. So I don't understand that discrepancy. One thing I do own is new, that is new, is Tiffany. And I bought it after Louis Vuitton made their bid. I bought it yesterday when Tiffany said, we don't think it's enough.
Right.
As opposed to, we're not for sale. That's a very different message. It's sort of, well, we know what
we're
you
open.
Are now. It's just a question of price. I think it has to be something close to 140, just because it did trade near there. And trophy properties always get sold. A premier name like this, you don't get that many tries at it. And I think Louis Vuitton will pay what they have to.
Haven't we seen this trend around the world in terms of luxury retail doing
sure have.
Pretty well, Kering, LVMH, good quarters.
If trade is back on, you're going to certainly see that. You're also going to see it at the expense of the big box retailers and staples. We talked about it. I think this rotation is extremely negative for those companies. I would leave it at that.
Up next, final trades. Should we do front men or should we do final trade?
Front
men are very interesting. Go to Twitter
trade,
if you want to know what we're talking about.
Final trade.
U.S. Steel on the move with other high leverage stocks in this environment.
Chairman.
Yeah, we're lost, but we're making good time. Capri, CPRI. I like it. Relative to Ralph, very cheap.
Nathan.
I'm throwing Eddie Vedder into the mix here. No, I think Square actually did what they needed to do. They kind of put a bottom in here. I like it with a 60 stop.
We missed your birthday, and I feel awful about it. So happy belated birthday, Melissa.
Happy birthday.
CBS, however, I think can go higher on all the noise we're hearing in this industry.
It was Monday, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
See you back here tomorrow at 5. Mad Money with Jim Cramer is up next.